This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 25th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as U.S. President Barack Obama addresses the United Nations, some scrutinize U.S. policy at home and abroad. Environmental activists and local residents block construction of the Keystone Pipeline set to run from Oklahoma to the Gulf Coast. And we'll go to Corpus Christi, Texas, where residents who lived near the problematic Citgo refinery are still waiting for action 5 years after its conviction for contamination. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld West Virginia's redistricting plan today, saying that variations in the number of people in each district don't violate the one-person, one-vote provision of the Constitution. A lower court had overturned the new map, drawn by a democratically controlled legislature, saying current mapping tools should prevent disparities in district population size. Today is National Voter Registration Day, and volunteers are mobilizing across the country and across social media. Zoe Sullivan reports on efforts to sign up voters in New Orleans.
According to organizers, 6 million people failed to vote in 2008 because they weren't registered. In New Orleans, churches and advocacy groups have come together to ensure that those who want to vote can. The MICA Project, a faith-based group focusing on social justice issues, has been working with 13 churches to register people over recent months. MICA has registered roughly 350 people so far and touched about 2,000, according to its executive director. Today, they began at 7 a.m. at a busy intersection in the heart of the city's commercial district. This evening, Moving Forward Gulf Coast, an organization dedicated to racial justice and rebuilding, will host an event at a local art center. They'll look at the history of voter suppression under Jim Crow and draw connections to current attacks on citizenship, such as new voter ID requirements. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
Voter ID requirements are on a Pennsylvania court docket today after the state's high court ruled last week that a lower court must make sure that government-issued IDs are easy to get. If not, the law must be blocked. A decision is due by next Monday. And voters in Florida will have fewer days to get to the polls after a federal judge ruled yesterday that the state can cut the number of early voting days by almost half. U.S. District Judge Timothy Corrigan said there was not enough proof that the move would impermissibly burden black voters. Judge Corrigan also said that Florida polls don't have to open on the Sunday before Election Day, despite a large minority voter turnout on the same day in 2008. Spanish police officers in riot gear blocked an Occupy Congress protest of thousands from reaching the Parliament building in downtown Madrid today. Clashes ensued. Robert Downs has more.
In the narrow streets that surround the Spanish Parliament building, protesters yelled for justice, but more than 1,000 police officers in riot gear blocked access to the building. Protester Libia Gasal said the police blocked the building to taint the public image of the protesters.
And I think it's just a way to say that we are not that many and we're not that strong, and that's the kind of things that they will tell later on in the news.
In the rush to cut $84 billion from the country's deficit by 2014, the government has enacted very unpopular austerity measures, tax rate hikes, higher fares for public transport, and salary cuts for public workers. Many expect Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy will soon request a full sovereign bailout. But protesters demand a referendum on the measure, as another bailout might come with even more austerity. But short-term borrowing rates on Spanish debt continue to rise, and the country needs capital. Another large protest is planned tomorrow to build support for a general strike. Robert Downs, FSRN, Madrid.
Nigeria is experiencing its worst floods in recent years, with 20 of the country's 36 states seriously affected. As many as 2 million people have been left homeless. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The worst hit area is Kogi State, where two of Africa's largest rivers, the River Niger and the Benue, meet. Both rivers flow into Nigeria from neighboring countries like Guinea, Mali, Niger, and Cameroon, where there had been heavy rainfall recently. Rescue officials say thousands of people are taking refuge in trees under life-threatening conditions. Thousands more have been stranded for up to 5 days on the highway linking northern and southern Nigeria after the road flooded. The queue of vehicles is said to stretch for more than 30 kilometers. Many of the passengers traveled with very little money. Some are selling what possession they have in their cars so as to get money for food. The scope of the flooding has overwhelmed authorities, and there are warnings that the situation will even get worse as more rains are expected. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
And Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled today that transgender citizens have the same constitutional rights as all other Pakistanis, including the right to inheritance and equal access to education and employment. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Several world leaders addressed the United Nations General Assembly in New York today, including U.S. President Barack Obama. He honored U.S. diplomatic personnel killed in Libya during recent protests and talked about what needs to be done to increase tolerance and stem violence in the transitioning Middle East. But some critics of the president's foreign policy say the U.S. must first acknowledge the role of its own militarism and repression at home and abroad before criticizing other nations. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
In his remarks to the UN General Assembly, President Obama focused on a key issue for the global forum, the Iranian government's pursuit of a nuclear energy program.
So let me be clear. America wants to resolve this issue through diplomacy, and we believe that there is still time and space to do so. But that time is not unlimited. We respect the right of nations to access peaceful nuclear power. But one of the purposes of the United Nations is to see that we harness that power for peace.
Repeating a common election trail theme, the president said a nuclear-armed Iran would threaten Israel and the entire region and vowed to prevent this from happening. But Trita Parsi with the National Iranian American Council praised President Obama for resisting pressure from Israel to oppose any nuclear enrichment at all in Iran. But he said the president's talk of preferring diplomacy to war has not been backed up by action.
Clearly, there's been some diplomacy, but in order for the diplomacy to work, it needs to be far more persistent and expansive than what it has been so far. It needs compromise from both sides. It needs concessions from both sides. So far, the way the behavior has been at the negotiating table has been one in which there's been a tremendous amount of hawkish negotiation tactics. So I just hope that all sides really invest in the diplomatic track.
Iranian Prime Minister Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will address the UN on Wednesday. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton held a round of diplomatic meetings this week with the presidents of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Libya, and Egypt. Just before the bilateral meeting with Libya on Monday, Clinton said the U.S. would continue to stand with the country's new leaders as they write their, quote, new future as a democracy. President Obama also touched on support for new democracies in his speech Tuesday, telling world leaders why the U.S. backed popular uprisings in Yemen, Egypt, and Libya over the past 2 years, and is currently supporting the Syrians rebelling against President Bashar al-Assad.
We have taken these positions because we believe that freedom and self-determination are not unique to one culture. These are not simply American values or Western values. They are universal values.
Some opponents of U.S. foreign policy say these comments don't match the reality on the ground, and U.S. support for dictators, monarchs, and other repressive governments in the region, both in the past and today, undermines the president's pro-freedom rhetoric. One critic is Palestinian-American writer Ali Abu Nima, who co-founded the online news site Electronic Intifada.
He singled out Iran and Syria for lacking democracy and abusing human rights. Okay, what about Saudi Arabia? What about Bahrain? What about Jordan? What about the United Arab Emirates or Morocco? Those are all countries that could use a bit of democracy. But of course, because they're close United States allies, he didn't mention that.
In his speech, the president condemned the violence that has left dozens dead during worldwide protests against a U.S. anti-Islamic film. He also emphasized protecting free speech, saying it applies even to offensive and inflammatory content like the anti-Islam video.
True democracy demands that citizens cannot be thrown in jail because of what they believe, and that businesses can be opened without paying a bribe. It depends on the freedom of citizens to speak their minds and assemble without fear.
While he agreed with some of this rhetoric, the Electronic Intifada's Abu Nima said the president has not defended these same First Amendment rights at home. This Friday, the Obama administration will argue before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals for the right to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens without trial. A lower court judge had blocked the challenge provision of the National Defense Authorization Act, saying there were no guarantees that activists and journalists wouldn't be targeted under the vague definition of material support for terrorism. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In eastern Texas, climate activists and local residents have blocked construction crews from TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline. According to activists, with tar sands blockade, two Texas residents locked themselves to construction machinery today, halting construction crews. Activists have also set up an 8-person tree village in the path of the pipeline and have vowed to remain to protect the area. The nearly 500-mile section of the pipeline runs from Cushing, Oklahoma to Nederland, Texas, and would initially transport up to 700,000 barrels of crude oil from the tar sands of Canada to the Gulf Coast, according to TransCanada. For more on today's action, we're joined by Ron Seifert, a climate activist and spokesperson for the tar sands blockade. He joins us from Wood County, Texas. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
The latest we heard is that the Wood County Sheriff Department has arrived to where two protesters are. What other updates do you have?
Yeah, that is exactly the latest. There are two protesters that have chained themselves to a piece of heavy equipment that was attempting to build a bridge through the backwoods of East Texas to allow for heavy equipment to continue slashing old growth forest to make way for the Keystone XL pipeline.
And they're all in the path of where the pipeline is scheduled to go.
That's correct.
The two that are chaining themselves to machinery in front of the village, tell us a little bit about them, where they're from, and why they decided to take this action.
Well, these are both native Texans, one from the Metroplex area, the Dallas area, another from the Houston area. And they both believe that stopping this pipeline is a necessary condition for our future. They're simply isn't room in our global climate budget for all the carbon that exists in the Alberta tar sands. If we allow the Keystone XL pipeline to open the floodgates to all that tar sands exploitation, it's game over for the future.
And as you mentioned, the Sheriff Department is there. Have there been any arrests so far?
As far as I'm aware of, not at this point, no.
And describe this section of land where activists are now and why it is important.
Well, Northeast Texas is a bit different than what people think of stereotypically when you think of Texas. It's the western boundary of the Ozark forest area, so there are beautiful forests. There's old growth trees. It's lush. It's green. And there's a lot of wells. There's a lot of springs. So this is where most of the big metro areas in Texas receive their water.
And talk about the role of eminent domain and how TransCanada was able to access this land and where the current situation is now.
Well, this multinational corporation is acting just like big government. They're acting like they are the state itself. They have seized private property unilaterally through a process that you named eminent domain, which basically is used to allow the state authority to take over private land if there's a public need or a public interest, like they need to build a highway, something along those lines. This is certainly not the case. This is a strictly private, for-profit project that has no public good in mind. Yet, for whatever reason, the state of Texas and the other states involving this Keystone XL pipeline have granted this extraordinary power to a multinational corporation.
And we're talking about Texas, but eminent domain has also been used in other states such as Oklahoma and elsewhere.
That's right. So far, of the 6 states that the proposed Keystone XL pipeline will cross in its route from Canada to the Gulf Coast, all 6 states are willing to give this company eminent domain entitlement.
You've outlined several of the concerns about this project that environmentalists, landowners, ranchers, others have also raised. In a statement, TransCanada said the Gulf Coast project would extend some 485 miles and called it a critical infrastructure project for the energy security of the United States and the American economy. And a spokesperson also said that the pipeline did not produce oil, just transported it, and that oil consumption is the driver of these kinds of projects. Your response to that justification?
Certainly, there's a couple of things there. First of all, this pipeline will have nothing to do with energy security in the United States. Tar sands is not conventional oil. It cannot possibly replace the conventional oil sources coming into the United States. They're two different things. There's a whole array of how crude oils are categorized, and TransCanada has often claimed that this tar sands will offset oil coming in from the Middle East. That's simply false. That type of sweet crude is very different from this heavy diluted bitumen slurry that they're pumping through. Additionally, all the refiners in the Gulf Coast are bragging about being able to sell this stuff to the highest bidder, to the developing world, which is really pining for diesel fuels right now. So they have no interest in keeping that product in the United States so long as there's someone out there in the world, which there is, to pay a higher price for it.
Ron Seifert is a spokesperson for the Tar Sands Blockade. He joined us from Wood County, Texas, where protesters have blocked the construction by TransCanada. Ron, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues, our investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people, and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters. Five years after a jury convicted the energy company Citgo of environmental violations, residents who lived near the problematic refinery are still waiting for restitution. While the felony charges were seen as a victory, now a judge is trying to determine who is a victim when an oil company is convicted of contaminating a neighborhood, or if there are any victims at all. The case could forge a new legal precedent. From Corpus Christi, Texas, FSRN's Andrew Oxford reports.
Mile after mile of shoreline along Corpus Christi's Nueces Bay is lined with refineries. The billowing smokestacks and chemical tanks loom large over the freeway as you drive into the Gulf Coast city. For the residents of the nearby Hillcrest neighborhood, one Citgo refinery is casting a particularly long shadow.
I've been here since 1968.
Darlene Wimbish lives in Hillcrest. Her bright yellow house is only a few blocks from Citgo Refinery East, but the Venezuelan oil company has not been the best neighbor.
Can't nobody explain why, you know, we have a high rate of bronchitis, you know, asthma, and that's my biggest thing, asthma. Even my little grandson right now, he got asthma. You know, nosebleeds, you know what I mean? Like I said, balls. My husband died with all kind of balls.
Wimbish and other residents had long suspected a series of health problems could be traced back to the nearby refineries. After years of campaigning by activists and investigations by state and federal regulators, their fears were confirmed.
Hey, hi, Susan.
Come on in. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Yeah.
Susie Canales does not live in Hillcrest, but she knows the neighborhood as well as anyone. An environmental justice activist, Canales spearheaded some of those investigations a decade ago.
We were concerned because of the high levels of benzene in the area, and we were concerned that Citgo specifically was to blame for it. Little did we know that they were, in fact, operating illegally.
In June 2007, a federal jury convicted Citgo of two felony violations of the Clean Air Act. Federal prosecutors argued the company had failed to cover two large oil tanks. For 10 years, toxins contaminated the air, which wafted into Hillcrest. The conviction was rare.
Usually they settle out of court, and then they are able to avoid all the discovery and, you know, the publicity.
More than 5 years after the conviction, the court has still not sentenced Sitgo. Paula Pierce, a lawyer with the Texas Legal Services Center, has been advocating for the residents of Hillcrest. She says the delay is really due to a simple question.
The court had to essentially figure out, okay, how are we going to determine who's a victim and who isn't?
In a 2008 ruling, presiding judge John Rainey said that the 300 people the government had claimed were victims of Sitgo's pollution were not victims at all. In fact, Rainey ruled later there may not be any victims if Hillcrest residents could not prove a connection between their injuries, medical or economic, and Sitgo. Canales remembers how the case evolved.
It was really a no-brainer that there were victims to the crimes. And so when he ruled that there were not victims, it was a huge disservice, a slap in the face.
Without the rights afforded by the Crime Victims' Rights Act, or CVRA, the residents of Hillcrest would be left out of the sentencing process and left out of restitution without medical services or even the chance to have their voices heard in court.
What these laws do is they give victims certain ways to participate in a criminal proceeding. The Crime Victim Rights Act gives victims a voice in the criminal justice process, and having that voice is valuable.
In July, Pierce and colleagues filed a new motion with the court. They argued that Hillcrest residents did not need to have medically documented proof of injuries. Breathing noxious gases and watching their property depreciate, among other things, classified them as victims. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals demanded Judge Rainey consider the motion. On September 14th, he ruled that the 16 residents in the motion were victims under the CVRA. For Canales, the ruling was a victory.
We were just like it was unbelievable.
Other residents may be included. The federal government found that more than 100 people could eventually be considered victims. A sentence has still yet to be handed down, but Canales warns the judge may leave them out of that process anyway.
He may not give the residents any restitution because he doesn't want to prolong the sentencing of Sitgo. Well, I sure hope that doesn't happen because, I mean, that would be so wrong to say, yes, there are victims, but you know what? We're not going to do anything for you because we just want to send in Sitgo.
Canales says most residents merely want to relocate at a reasonable price and leave the neighborhood they now fear is toxic. The Justice Department called for a maximum penalty of just over $2 million and a 5-year probation period. But the Sitgo East refinery alone generated more than $1 billion in profits during the 10 years it failed to comply with the Clean Air Act, according to the Justice Department. There are new worries, too. Earlier in September, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration accused Sitgo of 5 safety violations at the refinery. There have also been large releases of hydrofluoric acid at the plant and an explosion in 2009 that injured 2 employees. In the meantime, it remains to be seen what this month's ruling could mean for other environmental cases around the country.
Those people who, like I do, care deeply about victims having a voice in the criminal prosecutions that concern them when they've been harmed by a crime, will think of this case as being an important one, I think.
Back in Hillcrest, Darlene Wimbish is pleased victims could have more recognition from the court, even if she does not hold out much hope for restitution.
Now that the judge has done what he done, I can smile. Well, we don't get a penny.
Some things, she says, like the value of people's lives, are more important. Andrew Oxford, FSRN, Corpus Christi.
In Thailand, refugees and asylum seekers lack basic freedoms and face arbitrary and abusive conditions, according to a new investigation from U.S.-based rights group Human Rights Watch. In addition to restrictions on freedom of movement, earning income, and education, the rights group says refugees and migrant workers are harassed by police and authorities. From Bangkok, FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
Currently, there are more than 2 million refugees and migrant workers in the country, including about 140,000 refugees from Myanmar who live in camps along the border. But Human Rights Watch faults Thailand's government for having no refugee law or functioning asylum procedures. Bill Frelick is the Right Group's refugee program director.
Everything they do is ad hoc, and one group, one ethnic group within the Burmese are treated differently from another ethnic group within the camps. You have a supposed screening system that for the most part is dysfunctional, and where the definitions of who qualifies or doesn't qualify changes according to whatever purpose they want to serve at the particular time.
The call for change in policy comes as Myanmar undergoes political and economic reform under President Thein Sein, raising the prospect of the refugees returning home. But the government restricts the movement of refugees living in camps, some of which are remote and overcrowded. Human Rights Watch says this needs to change so refugees can get training and develop skills before returning home. The Thai government limits the role of the UN Refugee Agency in the country, preventing them from administering camps and from determining the status of North Korean, Lao, Hmong, and Burmese refugees. But Human Rights Watch says the UN should take a firmer stance in its dealings with the Thai government, including aiding Myanmar's ethnic Rohingya. The Rohingya do not have legal status under Myanmar's citizenship laws and thus are without travel documents. Abdul Garan, a 54-year-old Rohingya and father of two living in Thailand, said UN staff sent him to the camps on the Thai-Myanmar border, where he was then sent back to Bangkok.
UNHCR, I have two problems. Somebody, I want to go, my case Bangkok say, I asked to Bangkok, Bangkok said, no, no, you must be writing letter, something, please, yes. I cannot read, I can request, I cannot read, I cannot write. So you must be check my ANA number, my name, you can check. He said, no, no, no. Again, I want to go to UNHCR. My case, what happened to my case? I want to ask.
Garan says he fears for his life. He says Thai immigration officials have also been looking for him, and he's concerned he could be detained for months or years because he doesn't have a passport or other documentation.
What can I do, my brother? I don't know about for my life, my children. So I want to say that I am think too much now. Okay, my brother, I don't want to do now about for my life anywhere. America, Canada, anywhere, my brother, please.
Human Rights Watch is calling on Myanmar's government to immediately recognize or grant citizenship to the Rohingya. The group says this would be a major step forward in improving the country's treatment of refugees. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kamp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.